It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a political scientist about President Obama's foreign policy speech today. The president laid out the case for a strong military and strong restraint in the use of that military.
First, the shooting in California. Classes resumed today at UC Santa Barbara. On Friday, 22-year-old Elliot Roger went on a shooting spree on campus, killing 6 people and injuring 13 before turning the gun on himself. He posted a manifesto proclaiming he went on his rampage to seek revenge against women for denying him sex.
Our next guest says in order to prevent this sort of thing in the future, we need to look and talk about how race and misogyny played a role in this tragedy. Cliff Leek joins us. He's a graduate student in the Department of Sociology and program director for the Center for the Study of Men and Masculinities at Stony Brook University. Cliff, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, in a piece you co-wrote, you write that in the last 20 years, all but one school mass shooting has been committed by a white male. Do school shootings have that in common? What do we make of that?
Yeah, so it's really important to note, first of all, that that's talking about elementary and high schools. When you include universities, that number does go up a little bit. But when you're looking at elementary and high schools, it is 90% of those have been committed by white men. Once you start including colleges and universities, then the dynamics change a little bit because those places, for many shooters at those places, it's also a workplace. It's not just a place to go kill civilians.
So what is it about race, first of all, in this particular tragedy that struck you, that led you to write this piece?
So starting with the big shooting in Sandy Hook last, it was in December of 2012, we started really looking at race then. So we definitely started paying attention to it as soon as this case broke. But in this case in particular, it's really, really obvious because of the way that the shooter talks about race, both in his manifesto, if we really choose to call it that, and in his many online rants on YouTube. There's one quote in particular that really tells the story well from him, where he says, "How could an inferior, ugly black boy be able to get a white girl and not me? I am beautiful and I am half white myself. I am descended from British aristocracy. He is descended from slaves. I deserve it more." So that's what he's saying in his own words there. Yes, he is multiracial, but he's clearly placing his whiteness as something of value that should give him clout with women. And it's also in his rantings over and over again, he's talking about white blonde women being sort of the ideal object of his attraction as well. So in both ways, both in terms of the object of his attraction and how he views himself, he has a white supremacist viewpoint of this. In both ways, he sees white as better.
And then the other thread, one that's maybe gotten more attention, is the gender side of this, misogyny, an expectation, maybe a sense of entitlement that women should be having sex with him and they're not. This has really struck a nerve with a lot of people, women and men in this country. Can you expand on that a little?
Yes, absolutely. So this, sadly, it's actually not something that's brand new in terms of shootings. We do have previous cases where white men, in particular, have targeted women in these massacres. So two obvious ones are George Henard at the Luby's massacre in 1991, and more recently George Sodini at the Collier Township shooting in 2009. And both of these men targeted women specifically. And did so in framing it as, you know, these women are not attracted to me, I'm not getting what I deserve from women, and therefore I'm going to destroy them all.
Outside of mass shootings, which are thankfully rare, are these threads in our culture, are these things that people encounter on a daily basis, this sense of entitlement based on race or gender?
Yes, absolutely. And one of the things that's really come to light with this case is the pickup artist community. A lot of focus and attention has been given to that as sort of a a focal point of a lot of this in terms of gender, this misogyny. But that's not the only place that it's seen. I mean, in the aftermath of this shooting, there's been a Twitter hashtag, Yes All Women, which has really brought attention to all the various ways that women experience this on a day-to-day basis.
And I want to invite our callers to join in, especially on that thread. As a woman, have you tweeted things on that hashtag, Yes, All Women, or have you encountered that sort of daily hostility, the daily sense of entitlement from men, a sense of threat in your daily life? Call in at 800-642-1234, or as a man in our culture, do you see that going on around you at school, at work, at the bar? 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Cliff, as you say, that's really struck a nerve. A lot of people tweeting on that hashtag, a lot of people writing on this, and a backlash, a lot of it in the form of, and this has been going on for a while, men saying, wait, don't paint us all with this broad brush. We're not all like that. We don't all have this hostility toward women. What do you make of that kind of response?
Absolutely. So a lot of that response has been coming in also in the form of a Twitter hashtag, not all men. And I think it's really interesting because what that hashtag serves to do is for a lot of men, it's a way of saying, well, don't include me in this. I'm not like that. But unfortunately, I would argue that all men in our culture have absorbed some degree of sort of our misogynistic culture. We've all absorbed some amount of this messaging. Yes, many men actively combat it. In fact, there is a growing movement of men who are engaged in sexual and domestic violence prevention, and that's not just in the U.S., that's globally. So there are men actively combating this, in which case, you know, this not all men hashtag is in some ways appropriate. But unfortunately, this not all men hashtag is also being used to distract from the important conversation about misogyny. So when women are expressing what their experience have been, instead of asking questions about, okay, how can men be allies in changing this environment and changing this behavior, the response is instead, well, not me. That's not me. So I think that sort of reframing it from a not all men to a what can men do would be a really important shift.
What can men do?
So there's a tremendous amount that men can do. I think the first and foremost is we can be good allies with our brothers, our family members, our friends. When we encounter this sort of misogynistic culture in our day-to-day lives, when we encounter the sort of language that is seen in these pickup artist communities, we have a tremendous amount of influence with other men to address that and say, you know, hey, let's talk about where this is coming from. Let's talk about women as people. So we have a tremendous amount of clout with other men to have those conversations. But unfortunately, at least in my experience working with other men, we're actually more likely to have these conversations with women than we are with each other.
So where is this anger, maybe bitterness coming from, whether we're talking about the shooter this weekend or maybe just the daily interactions, daily hostilities between men and women? Where is that coming from?
So in both this piece and a few others that that Michael Kimmel and I have written, we've used the language of aggrieved entitlement. So it's the notion that men oftentimes feel entitled to women and to women's bodies, and also to a lot of other successes in life. So whether that's the right job or the right house or the right education, all of these things, a lot of young men and boys are when we grow up, are told, you know, these things can all be yours. And not only that these things can all be yours, but you deserve all of these things. But we are now living in a world that is a lot more of a meritocracy than it was 30 or 40 or 50 years ago. Still certainly not a perfect meritocracy. But we're now living in a world where these things don't come as easily to men as they maybe did 30 or 40 years ago. That's not to say that men are suffering or oppressed or anything like that, but the playing field is leveling a bit. And when you're used to a tilted playing field, or you're told going into the game that the playing field is going to be tilted, and then it's not, you experience this sense of aggrieved entitlement. You feel it's unjust. You feel that you've been cheated.
So the old advantages that one might have been able to assume, those rules don't apply anymore?
I wouldn't quite go that far. Okay. I think they apply less now than they used to, and we're seeing those changes. But they definitely are, they're fading, but they're definitely still present.
We're talking to sociologist Cliff Leek about, in part, the shooting this weekend in California, and more broadly, about how misogyny, hostility, bitterness of men toward women, and issues of race and the sense of aggrieved entitlement he was just talking about all play into it.
And we'd like to hear from you on this one. Do you think our culture has a problem with misogyny and racist entitlement? Why or why not? And have you seen this in action? As a woman, have you encountered the kind of hostility from men that our guest is talking about and that people in the blogosphere are talking about, the internet? Call in and share your experiences and ideas at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send us email to talk@wpr.org. We're continuing our conversation with sociologist Cliff Leek about how misogyny and entitlement and issues of race played into the Santa Barbara shooting last week.
And we'll take your calls in just a moment at 800-642-1234. It can be difficult to talk about, but as a woman, do you encounter these issues from time to time on a daily basis? Men feel entitled to your time, aggrieved if you don't give them the time of day, if you don't have sex with them. And that's the grievance raised by the shooter this weekend. As a man, do you see this around you, among your friends, family, people you've met? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll go to Michelle on the line now in Madison. Michelle, hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. Your question was, as a woman, do I encounter a male sense of entitlement? And my answer is yes, I think all women in the United States encounter a certain amount of this every day. In my experience, I was a graduate student with another gentleman who was a little older than me, but I was working there for 5 years, and he began there. Every day I had to show up at 8 o'clock. Every day he showed up at 11 o'clock. He took two-hour lunches. I worked throughout my lunch. He went home every day about 3 or 4. I stayed until the job was done, until about 6. We got the same degree. You know, there was a situation where I was trying to teach him something on the computer because, as I said, I had seniority, and I couldn't find the print button. And I said, you know, where the heck is the print button? I'm a Mac person. I was on a PC. And so then the next day we both showed up at the farm. You know, I eventually found the print button. We both showed up at the farm. And I was to train him how to manage our cows. And he showed up so angry, he was sweating and shaking. And I didn't understand what was going on. And he had his fist clenched. He eventually was shouting at me that I made him feel like a little boy. He punched the side of the barn. He picked up rocks and threw it at me. And at that point, I ran away. And I asked my supervisor later, what was that? And he said that I had insulted his computer, and thus I had insulted him.
Hmm. Well, thank you for sharing that story, Michelle. And an expectation that women have to deal with men's anger on the workplace and elsewhere. A common story, Cliff?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think a great deal of the time women are sort of expected to be, not only our anger, but just expected to be the vessels of our emotions in general. Because, you know, heaven forbid we as men express those emotions to one another or learn how to cope with them as well. So one of the things that comes up a great deal in these conversations about these mass shootings is this question of mental health. And what we do know about men and boys is that we don't seek mental health when we mental health services when we need it. So I think that definitely could be a factor here.
Michelle, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Katie in Bayfield. Katie, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I was just interested in bringing up the idea of dismissal versus hostility. I am a minority female, and I'm younger. I mean, I'm only 29. And one of the things, I'm pretty articulate. I'm relatively well-educated. I came from a family that, you know, I was really empowered as a person. And going through life, what I found was much less hostility and much more of an outright dismissal of, well, let's just turn away from this conversation, let's not continue, let's walk away from this, or whatever it was. Throughout everything, even from being like a younger child, middle school, high school time, all the way up through now, you know, in the working environment and whatnot, it's just easier to dismiss someone, I guess, like me.
Katie, thank you so much for your call. Dismissing, overlooking contributions, the input of a woman and a member of a minority, Cliff.
Yeah, that's also something that's very, very present in the research. There's some really great research, and I truly wish I could remember the author of it at the moment. But there is a lot of really great research about men interrupting women in meetings. And men are far more likely to interrupt their female colleagues in meetings and even just in everyday life than they are to interrupt men. So it very much is an issue of, you know, well, I'm the man, so clearly I know better because I've been taught that I know better my whole life.
There's a lot of advice out there for women dealing with that situation. Is there a lot of advice out there for men to not do that?
I wouldn't say there's a lot, but it is growing. So there's, as I mentioned earlier, there is a growing movement of men involved in sexual violence prevention and domestic violence prevention. But if you look around online, there's just a growing movement of men that refer to themselves as either feminist or pro-feminist. So this growing feminist or pro-feminist men's movement, a great deal of it is about understanding the ways we as men can start to address these problems amongst ourselves before they become problems for the women in our lives.
Back to the phones now. We've got Don on the line in Norwalk. Don, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, I definitely agree that there's this this sort of spirit of aggrieved entitlement that's sort of, you know, out there. But I kind of think I see a sort of an opposite cause for it. I don't think it's something that people are picking up from the culture. I think it's because of something they're not picking up from the culture. And that's just a certain sense of restraint, civility. It's like if people don't get what they want, it's like everybody's got an ego. And without the proper education and formation, it becomes a sort of imperial ego. And it needs to be encouraged and restrained to do the social thing.
Don, and thanks a lot for the call. Not much time left. I want to get Cliff in. Almost a psychological approach to train us to be better, more respectful of everyone, I guess.
Absolutely. I think it does come from sort of both sides of the coin. Like we do learn the notion that we deserve instant gratification is learned just as much as this, you know, sort of sense of entitlement is learned. So while he's saying what we aren't picking up is this notion of restraint, I completely agree with that. But at the same time, you only need restraint if you feel that you deserve instant gratification.
Thanks for the call, Don. Cliff, just a minute and a half left or so, and I don't know if we've gotten to the awfulness of some of the response to that. I mean, there were things online, people tweeting in response to some of the things we were talking about, applauding the shooter, applauding the message he sent in particular to women. Is there a lot more out of this than we believe or would want to believe?
I think absolutely there is. So we have a long history in the U.S. of backlashes every time we have progress. So I think the easiest example of this is looking at Jim Crow as a backlash to Reconstruction. So Reconstruction gave a lot more liberty and rights to African Americans in the U.S., and then immediately afterwards we institute Jim Crow as a backlash to that. In the 90s, we had an anti-feminist backlash against all of the feminist accomplishments of the 70s and 80s. And I would argue, and my co-author Michael would probably be with me on this, that what we're actually seeing now is another form of backlash that is both racial and gendered as well as classed. So we've had a lot of progress in the last 20 or 30 years, and these different forms of backlash are coming together and coming to a head at this sort of historical moment right now.
Cliff, we'll leave it there for now. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Cliff Leek. He's a graduate student in sociology and program director for the Center for the Study of Men and Masculinities at Stony Brook University.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, after a runoff primary in Texas last night, there'll be no more World War II veterans in Congress beginning next year. We'll take a look at that and other news from this week in Congress.
First, we're talking about President Obama's foreign policy speech at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point today. In his speech, the president outlined his foreign policy vision. He argued the United States should use its strong military and diplomatic tools to exert influence and provide global leadership.
Andrew Kidd is with us now to break down the plan. He's professor of political science at UW-Madison. Andy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So it seems like the president is balancing, making the statement, we have a strong military, a military that we should be willing to use when necessary, but we should be very careful about how and when we use it. How do you think he struck that balancing act?
Well, I think he struck it in the way that he's been trying to strike it for a while, and he's been trying to wind down the military commitments that he inherited at the beginning of his administration, most prominently, of course, the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan. And he just announced recently that the war in Afghanistan, the American troop commitment to Afghanistan, is going to be wrapped up by 2016 when he leaves office. And that sort of puts an end to that. And his idea of how it ought to be moving forward is that we avoid large-scale commitments of force like that and instead exercise a lot more caution on when we use force. He mentioned it primarily in the context of terrorism and counterterrorism, and when we have to defend direct threats to the United States, which he thought of as primarily terrorist in nature in terms of actual violence. And then other things would not be responded to with force. It would be, or at most would be responded to multilaterally with force in some cases, like for instance the Libyan intervention. So definitely a more scaled back approach than previously, and kind of in keeping with what he's been doing so far.
And critics for some time now, especially Republican critics, have said that the president hasn't been forceful enough with dictators around the world, nations like Syria, don't take the threat of potential U.S. military response seriously. They're probably going to respond, hey, you're more or less giving a green light to these countries, saying whatever you do, as long as it's not a direct threat to the United States, force isn't going to be there. Is that going to tie our hands in the future?
It's not clear that it's going to tie our hands more than they are tied by our own preferences at this point. There's a lot of reluctance in the United States to get involved in foreign conflicts, understandably, given the past over 10 years of wartime experience for the United States. So the Syrian case, for instance, Obama was not alone by any means in his reluctance to get involved in Syria. It was really only the fact that he almost accidentally drew this red line vis-a-vis chemical weapons that forced his hand to act, and then he was very happy to be let off the hook, in a sense, when the Russian proposal, well, actually Kerry's own proposal, subsequently embraced by the Russians, converted this from a humanitarian crisis to an issue of chemical weapons disarmament, which has actually proceeded pretty successfully as far as it goes, but certainly isn't doing anything to help the people who are dying from the civil war that's actually being fought there. So there was not a lot of reluctance, not a lot of enthusiasm to go into Syria, and there's not a lot of enthusiasm to do anything, for instance, in the other big recent case, which would be Ukraine, using U.S. military force. So he's not exactly out on a limb there in terms of American public opinion.
And he makes the case that even if we're not diving in headfirst with military intervention, the United States, he says, has to play a strong leadership role in the world. If we don't, no one else will. Is the American public willing to accept that leadership role outside of the military side of things?
Yeah, I think that's within what the American public opinion is willing to tolerate. In fact, is supportive of in many ways, almost insistent of. Another thing that struck me about his speech is his statement that he believes with every fiber in his being or something in American exceptionalism, right? The idea that the United States is special in the world, we have a special mission, which is the kind of rhetoric that drives other countries crazy because they think that they have special missions too. But Americans certainly believe that. And so he's not really outside the mainstream in that regard. And there's a certain degree of truth to it, right? The United States is still the strongest country in the world. A lot of countries look to it for leadership on various issues. And so it's not, you know, it's not especially controversial in that regard. And I think the United States people will support that, provided it doesn't become too costly in the way that the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War did.
Do you think that reluctance, again, in the public here to embrace large-scale use of force is something that comes on the, you know, after the Iraq War, after the Afghanistan War, and over time that war fatigue might fade away, we might forget the lessons there and be more willing to embrace large-scale military action?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's something you see over time, right? The aftermath of Vietnam really didn't last that long in the broad sweep of things. People were very reluctant to intervene after Vietnam in the 1970s, viewing Vietnam as a disaster. And I mean, over 50,000 people, American soldiers, were killed in Vietnam, far more than were killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. But then by 1980, Ronald Reagan was elected on a policy of getting tough with the Russians and beefing up military spending, and the Vietnam hangover was supposedly over. He didn't actually himself intervene in any wars in a big way, although he certainly helped forces here and there in Afghanistan, for instance, and Nicaragua. But then by 1990-91, when Iraq invaded Kuwait, the United States was prepared to intervene with massive force. So the Vietnam hangover had been outlasted by that point. So I think there's definitely one can look forward to in 5 or 10 years that the United States may be more interested in intervening abroad at that point. But for now, it would seem that Obama is more or less in tune with the times in terms of not wanting to intervene. And the big question is, as you asked before, like, is this going to embolden bad guys around the world, to put it bluntly, people like Assad, people like Putin? And to some extent, it may. On the other hand, it wasn't to do otherwise, if you're not actually willing to intervene, essentially to attempt to bluff, which is probably not advisable in most cases because bluffs can get called. And then they're exposed as being hollow, and that damages reputation even more. You have to balance these things and strike some sort of middle course, and that's, I think, what Obama was trying to do.
And the president made the case that the threats we face, the direct threats to the United States, are not a nation state, not a concentrated group like al-Qaeda was in Afghanistan, but the metastasized remnants of al-Qaeda, the local organizations in places like North Africa and the Middle East and elsewhere. Do you see a continuation of things like drone strikes and other actions against those local terrorism groups?
Yeah, that does still seem to be something he supports, although he did mention, and he has, over the past year or so, tried to move towards making it more transparent, making it more subject to oversight and sort of legal restraints of one form or another, transferring it away from the CIA to the Defense Department, for instance. So I think he's trying to make that a little bit less cloak and dagger and outside the sphere of law. But he does still seem to be viewing that as a potential use of American power, direct American power. But he's also emphasizing cooperative relations with states in the region that have their own reasons to want to fight these sort of franchisees of al-Qaeda, supporting them in their actions with intelligence and special forces training and potentially them allowing our special forces to go in and attack certain targets. So I would imagine that sort of activity will continue on, although perhaps at a somewhat lower level than certainly was going on in Afghanistan for a long time.
Andy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks.
That was Andrew Kidd, professor of political science at UW-Madison. It's time for our weekly look at Congress. Paul Singer is off this week. We're joined today by USA Today congressional correspondent Susan Davis.
After a mass shooting near Santa Barbara this weekend, one father told the public and Congress that the responsibility for his son's death is in the hands of politicians.
Also, the oldest member of Congress and one of the last World War II veterans in office lost to his primary challenger last night. He's the first incumbent in this election cycle so far to be pushed out.
We round up the happenings in Congress every week at this time. Susan Davis joins us now. Susan, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, last week we talked about widespread wins for establishment Republicans over Tea Party candidates in primaries around the country. And we have the flip side of that narrative right now with Representative Ralph Hall of Texas losing to a Tea Party challenger who spent a lot of his own money on the campaign. Does that change the main thrust of the message from last week?
Not necessarily. I think Texas is a little bit of a different case. And even so much of this narrative of Tea Party versus establishment, not all of it fits into one very neat, clean box. What was interesting in Texas, and I think part of what contributed to Ralph Hall's defeat yesterday, was the very nature of a runoff election. Most politicians don't want to go into a runoff, particularly one in the summertime when even fewer people are going to turn out, and often the people that do turn out tend to be more anti-incumbent than not. This doesn't necessarily fit into the neat Tea Party narrative because Ralph Hall also had a number of Tea Party support. In some ways, you could maybe attribute this to Texas always doing it their own way, but he had the support of the NRA, which is a hugely influential group. He had the support of Ron Paul, which obviously has a significant amount of support within Texas as well. And the U.S. Attorney John Radcliffe, who beat him, isn't necessarily, he served in the Bush administration. He was a wealthy self-funder. He wasn't necessarily the archetypal anti-establishment candidate. Ralph Hall is, I believe he's 91 years old. He wasn't necessarily prepared for this campaign. I think it snuck up on him a little bit. And one of the lessons that we have learned from Tea Party uprisings is that if incumbents don't watch their back, they're much more vulnerable.
Well, and one of the other side notes of this is that due to Hall's loss, starting next year, there aren't going to be any more World War II veterans serving in Congress. Did they play an important role in the shaping of the legislature? What is the significance of him not being there?
I think it's hugely significant. It's also just an interesting historical mark. John Dingell, who is the longest-serving member of Congress in history and also a World War veteran, is retiring this year. So at the start of the next Congress in January, it will be the first time that World War II veterans are no longer serving. A couple of names that stick out to me when you think about World War II veterans and what they did. Bob Dole, a former Senate Majority Leader, was a World War II veteran and to this day still does a lot of advocacy work for those veterans. Senator Daniel Inouye, who was the head of the Appropriations Committee and was hugely influential in the development of Hawaii and Alaska, who passed away last year, was a World War II veteran. Most recently, Frank Lautenberg, who was a Democratic senator, who played a lot of roles in anti-smoking legislation and advancing public health causes. So their legacy is very real in Congress, and I think it's, on the whole, many of the World War II legislators that served were some of the most distinguished of the modern era.
Yeah, so you really make it sound like an era is coming to a close and maybe another beginning with this passing.
I think it's true, and what's interesting is we've certainly seen the number of veterans in Congress dip, and I've written about this, and part of it is just the reality of not having a draft anymore. You're going to naturally have less veterans because it's a volunteer army. But also what we've seen is the number of veterans that are rising and that dominate among the veterans in Congress now are Iraq and Afghanistan veterans who bring a whole different legacy and a whole different view of foreign policy to Congress, and I think we're just at the beginning stages of how they are going to shape policy over the next 20, 30 years the way that World War II veterans did in the post-war era.
Well, moving on to some big news from the weekend, a young man shot and killed three people in East La Vista, California. And one of the people killed was 20-year-old Chris Martinez. And his father, Richard, has gotten a lot of attention for blaming politicians with a lot of emotion, a lot of passion for his son's death on national television. And we have a little bit of a clip.
Chris died because of craven, irresponsible politicians and the NRA. They talk about gun rights. What about Chris's right to live? When will this insanity stop? When will enough people say, stop this madness? We don't have to live like this.
Obviously a lot of pain there. It's difficult to listen to. Will it affect the politics of gun control?
The short answer is no. And I agree with you that it's very heartbreaking to have to listen to that, and particularly any parent that has lost a child, and particularly in a very violent way, as his son lost his life. But it doesn't change the dynamics in Congress. And I would say why this shooting is no more different than the others is I don't think if Congress was not going to act after the Newtown shootings that killed, you know, 20 first graders, I'm not sure that the latest is going to be the thing that changes the dynamic. The votes haven't changed. They still don't have 60 votes in the Senate. Harry Reid has said if he can get to 60, he'll bring it back and they'll pass it, but they don't have that support. The House of Representatives, controlled by Republicans, that have never held a vote on any new gun legislation in this Congress post the Newtown shootings. And I don't see that changing. And I don't get the sense that there's a lot of urgency within Congress to act. And quite frankly, they just don't have the majority support that it would take to pass significant new gun legislation. And it is very true to say that the NRA still remains one of the most powerful lobbying forces in Washington. So for advocates that are seeking tighter gun laws, it's going to be a very long, protracted fight, and it's not going to happen this year.
So does that mean that gun laws in America are the way people want them to be? Is that the conclusion we can draw from the fact that nothing new has been pushed through?
Fascinating about it too is where we have seen legislation is on the state level, and I think in some respects that's the way Congress would prefer it. At least Republicans in Congress would prefer to have states play a more active role in deciding how they want their own gun laws to be. But what is really stunning is more gun laws have been loosened or expanded since Newtown versus tightened, or in other words, there's been less gun control since Newtown, and if anything, there's been laws to make it easier to get guns or loosen restrictions on reporting requirements in different states. So I think it's two things. I think do not underestimate the power of the gun voter. I think that people that are motivated by gun rights vote on that single issue. I can't think of perhaps maybe abortion, but I think guns is even more powerful than abortion on a single vote issue in that it drives more people to the polls. So I think the passion factor, and it may seem unlikely given when you hear the passion in the voice of people like that father that we just heard the clip of, but we've seen it time and time again that the gun rights voter shows up. And they show up in large numbers. So I do think it does create a vacuum in which, even though we have polls that show a majority of Americans support things like tighter background checks or maybe tougher sales for assault-like weapons, it doesn't translate into political reality, in part because the people that are more likely to actually show up and cast a ballot do not feel that way.
Well, there has been some movement last week in Congress on legislation affecting the NSA and the House passing some restraints there. What was decided?
They passed the bill that they passed, which has a good chance of actually becoming law because there's a companion bill in the Senate and they're going to take that up later this summer, essentially ends bulk data collection, which it takes a role out of the NSA that was just sweeping up all of these records. Now, it doesn't necessarily end the practice. What it does do is it creates a new check on the NSA power, where phone companies still have to keep their phone records for 18 months. That's current law. That didn't change, and that won't change. But now the NSA will have to go through, get a court order, and make the case for why they would need, for instance, my phone records if they had reason to believe that I was communicating with forces, terroristic alliances in or outside the United States. So it creates a new check on that power, but it doesn't fundamentally change their ability to do it. And I think we saw in the closing days before the House passed that, a lot of the original supporters pulled back their support. They dropped from the bill some provisions that would have put a public advocate on the court. They also dropped reporting requirements that would require the government at least on an annual basis to give us a sense, not tell us what numbers they're looking at, but tell us how many so we get a scope of the size of this program. In the Senate, Patrick Leahy, who's the Senate Judiciary Chairman who has the jurisdiction over this bill, says he's going to try and put those provisions back in. And we also saw a lot of the tech companies pull their support. Originally, Google, Facebook, Twitter had signed on to this bill, but they now see language that they believe is a loophole that would allow the government to look at internet data. Now, the government and lawmakers who support the bill say they're overreading it, and that's not the intention, but they withdrew their endorsement and said they would like to see tighter language in there before they can support the final bill. So it has some hurdles to go through, but this is initially what President Obama asked for, and there's support for it in the Senate. And if it does make it over the final hurdle, mm-hmm. it will be one of the few accomplishments of this Congress, and it will pretty much be the only congressional response to the Edward Snowden leaks.
And we leave it there. Susan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We were talking to Susan Davis, congressional correspondent for USA Today. Paul Singer will be back with us next week. We look at the week in Congress every Wednesday at this time.